Welcome, guys, to episode 175 of Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name is James Gearing, and I am really excited to bring to you my next guest, retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Janelle McCauley. Now, what made this interview so powerful is, amongst all the other roles that she held, she was a director of human performance and leadership for the 58th Special Operations Wing within the Air Force. And what she talks about with her role there is so applicable to first responder community as well. So we talk about maximizing performance. We talk about the effect of sleep deprivation, nutrition, exercise, mental practice. So much great information here. And in this intro, I want to make one more point. Thank you, Ryan May, for connecting us. I just want to point out that when you guys make suggestions, I do listen. Obviously, it depends on the person, but this was such a great fit, and I'm so glad that I was introduced to Janelle, and you're going to see why this interview is incredible. So with that being said, as I always say, please go to your podcast app, subscribe to the show, rate the show, leave feedback. I do always read that as well. And most importantly, use social media for the positive, powerful force that it can be, and share these episodes. There's so much information from every single person I had on the show, and all you have to do is just talk about it and share it, and you can help spread the word and grow this project. So that being said, I introduce to you Lieutenant Colonel Janelle McCauley. Enjoy. Lieutenant Colonel Janelle McCauley, firstly, I want to start by saying thank you so much. We were connected on Twitter, and when I actually explored who you were and your incredible career so far, I was absolutely blown away and realized that you were definitely a must-have. So thank you for agreeing to come on the podcast.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here, especially since, and I don't know if you, this was somewhere deep in the crypts of my bios, but my dad was actually in law enforcement. He was a police officer and detective for about 30 years in Southern California. So I kind of grew up, you know, with, you know, my mom was a nurse as well. So both my parents being public servants, and especially with my dad understanding kind of the stress and the demands of the job. So I am just completely honored to be able to share some of my insights and experience to hopefully have an impact on your community. So thanks for having me.
Well, thank you. I want to start with that. I always talk about the, you know, the early life first, and you've already told me what your parents did. Were you an only child, or did you have brothers and sisters?
I have a younger brother, and he actually happens to also have gone to the Air Force Academy like I did, and is a pilot in the Air Force. So he's still active duty. Yeah, he's a few years younger than me. But yeah, we are kind of an Air Force and public servant family, definitely.
Brilliant. And you had military even in your grandparents, is that right?
I did, yes. Both my grandfathers, I had two grandfathers that were in the Marine Corps, and one of them was a Mustang. So he basically went through, you know, all the ranks and then eventually retired as a lieutenant colonel, starting, you know, back in World War II is when he enlisted. And so he was a big influence in my life. In fact, everybody used to always call him Colonel. Like, that's kind of just how he, you know, we'd walk into a restaurant and everyone would be like, you know, hello, Colonel. And my dad even called him that. And so when I reached the rank of lieutenant colonel, it was almost surreal to me to have, you know, accomplished, you know, that feat and gotten that promotion, because it was so revered. You know, since my grandfather, that was kind of what I remember him being. So that was really special to me. And then my uncle actually flew. He was a Marine as well. So my family actually encouraged me to go to the Air Force, even though they were all Marines. but my uncle flew Marine One for President Reagan. So that was really interesting as well.
Absolutely, yeah. Now, when you were young, and I've heard you talk about this, so I'm asking the specific question, when you were a little 7-year-old girl, being a ballet dancer or a princess was not your career aspiration, was it? So what were your goals as this tiny child?
So it was interesting because I loved to do things like ballet. I was actually a baton twirler and a gymnast, and But my dad used to tell people from that young age that I was going to grow up and, you know, fly airplanes or be a submarine warfare commander. And at the time, you know, female aviation was very limited. Definitely, we weren't allowed to fly fighter aircraft, and submarines were off limits. But I kind of grew up not understanding, you know, gender barriers to what I could accomplish in the future. So that was a very powerful thing as a young girl to kind of learn that, you know, I could be a dancer, whoever I want to be, and I could grow up to achieve whatever it is I want to achieve, even if it kind of is, you know, against the stereotype of the gender norms, especially for the time.
Yeah.
So yeah,
but it's just interesting when I heard you talking about that, because like you said, you weren't aware of those barriers, therefore those barriers didn't factor into your thought process and your initial career goals. And I think that's such a powerful philosophy, even as a small child, is if no one tells you what you can't do in the first place, your limitations are very few then. Whereas the moment you're pigeonholed and told, well, you know, you're this, you're that, then you can only do, you know, these are the only careers you can do, you're immediately imprisoned from a young age, and your corridor becomes a lot narrower.
Exactly. And that's why the messaging we use both with ourselves and especially with our children is so important, because we can really shape kind of those perspectives. And it's almost like this, an unconscious bias that can develop, you know, if you hear certain things a certain way about not being able to achieve certain milestones or career aspirations in the future. And so that's why it's really important for us to kind of keep, you know, when we can go into the mindsets a little bit further into the podcast, but, you know, I would say the growth mindset piece for us all to kind of focus more on the process instead of just the end results and what, you know, the roadblocks are to get there.
Yeah, we'll definitely explore that. So I want to start though with your entry into the Air Force then. So firstly, you know, what lead us through that, but secondly, when officially did those barriers get dropped where women were allowed to do the positions that they were not when you were younger?
So I entered the Air Force Academy in 1994, and that was actually the first year they let women fly fighter aircraft and go, you know, into that type of career field in combat. And so that was, you know, from kind of day one of my entry into the Air Force, that kind of door had been opened. However, I think most female pioneers or any type of minority pioneer would always say, you know, just because the door was open does not mean that the challenges stopped. And so there were still definitely challenges associated with kind of going into that type of career field at that time. You know, there's still a lot of individuals that were not, I would say, too accepting, you know, of the change in the status quo that had been for so long. But I would say the majority of the folks that I encountered across my Air Force career, you know, my time at the Air Force Academy and in pilot training, I would say there were a lot of folks that were very supportive. And then I think the other factor is, especially, you know, as one of the first to kind of challenge some of those stereotypes, you know, you just have to be really good at what you do and be focused at it and, you know, be hardworking and kind of get all the training that you need and take it seriously. And so I think that was also key to my success in my career field, was that I was always, you know, it was very important to me to be really good at what I did, and to put in the hard work and drive and effort to get there.
Yeah, that's something that we see in our professions. And, you know, I see the ignorance and the prejudice amongst some people, many of whom tend to be the ones that aren't particularly good at their job in the first place. And that's why they're threatened. But then you have the pendulum swinging the complete opposite way sometimes, where now, you know, they're filling quotas. Oh, we need X amount of this type of person. And they're lowering standards, which again, like you were saying, being good at your job is such a slap in the face of, you know, the woman, the minority, whatever group that was being, kept out of that profession before. And those men and women stepped up and probably far exceeded whatever bar was there to make sure that they, you know, showed everyone else that the damn right they had a place to, you know, a reason to, or a right to be in that profession. But by lowering it now, to get bums on seats, as it were, I always find it very disrespectful to the women that, let's just take women for this example, that have stepped up and, as you said, become the best they can possibly be in that profession.
Yes, I can agree with that. I think that there's no need to lower any type of standards. I think that, you know, diversity is important, but within that diversity, there's a lot of very qualified candidates that are capable of meeting or exceeding the standards. And so there should never really be a need to kind of lower that bar in any way. And yeah, as someone that's always had to work hard to kind of not make, you know, I don't want to hide my gender. I want to be very clear about that. Like because I tend to sometimes say, well, I don't want to make my gender an issue. I just want to do the job. But at the same time, you know, it's not like I can hide the fact that I'm a woman. So, you know, it's there. It's not to be hidden. It just should not be a factor in how I complete my job, if that makes sense.
No, it does completely. And the example I use with the fire service is when we're all masked up in our bunker gear, you have no idea if we're male, female, gay, straight, black, white, you know, Christian, Muslim. You're just a firefighter that you can physically see can either do the job or can't do the job. And I think that's, you know, a symbolism of how our profession should be, is you either can or you can't. And of course, you, how do you identify James? Oh, he's the pasty Englishman with the crooked teeth. You know, yeah, that's my physicality, but, you know, that doesn't factor into whether I can do the job or not. So I agree 100%.
Yes, yes, I do. And I think it's also important, you know, at times to show the younger generation, you know, the success stories that we can, that we have, you know, in those, with those minorities, kind of highlighting those aspects, I think, so that, you know, those younger girls and younger folks that kind of can look up and think, this is normal. You know, like, I think it's very important to me for my son and my daughter as well, to understand that, you know, I was a pilot for many years, and, you know, my son's only six. And so there's a part of me now that I've retired from the Air Force and I'm kind of taking on this new career. Like, I don't want him to forget, you know, what I did and what his mom had done and accomplished, because I want him to grow up in a world where he sees women pilots just as a norm. Because I, you know, I'll still go to schools and I'll talk about being a pilot, or I've brought, you know, wore my flight suit and I brought my helmet in, and people are like, oh, wow, you're a mom and you're a pilot. Like, it's a rare thing. And I just kind of, I would love to see our culture come to a space where that becomes a normal thing. Like, oh, that's cool, your mom's a pilot. And, you know, I've seen a woman pilot in the cockpit before. So it's going to be generational. It'll come. But, you know, telling those stories and seeing the diversity out there and people doing their job, putting in the effort and being accomplished at it is vitally important.
Absolutely. Now, what was it that caused that change in 94? What were the, you know, who were the people, or what was the movement that kind of removed that ridiculous prejudice that was there prior?
You know, I don't know the exact history and I don't want to misquote it, but I that is when, you know, the law was passed to say that females could fly into combat zones, which then opened up, you know, a couple different types of flying, like aviation jobs, fighter pilots being one of them. We also had special operations aircraft, combat, rescue helicopter type flying. And so those cockpits now opened up for females to go in there. Because prior to that, there was a ban on females being in different types of combat positions. So that, and there's still, I think, you know, and now even 94 is when some of the aviation jobs had opened up, and across, you know, the last 20 years, now we have, you know, women going in to be Army Rangers and different positions in, you know, submarines. So I think, you know, we're slowly but surely opening up the aperture of what women are capable of doing, especially in the military. And the interesting thing is, and I don't know the complete history with the law enforcement and first responders, but, you know, that's a very high stress frontline job. And, you know, women also have been doing that and are doing that, you know, across the country.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, then, so you obviously ended up at a very high level within the infrastructure of the military. When you first went in, what was your kind of philosophy as far as, you know, how you were in your initial career and then your path as far as leadership to progress through the chain of command?
So I started off as a pilot. So, and kind of the way the military does things is, you know, we're trained to be a technical expert in some sort of career field. So mine was aviation and flying. And so I did that for about 13 years, flying 3 different aircraft within the Air Force inventory, doing multiple deployments, upgrading to instructor and evaluator in those aircraft. And then the Air Force sent me back to school for a couple years, kind of leadership, training, furthering education. I got a couple master's degrees. And then I was sent to do some staff work, which is kind of like a rite of passage for most military officers. You have to spend some time at the Pentagon or some major command, working policies and regulations. And in my case, I actually worked in weapons of mass destruction. And I don't know if you remember when Syria turned over their, majority of their chemical weapons, I won't say all, but they turned over chemical weapons and we destroyed them on a ship in the middle of the Mediterranean. And that was the mission I ran while I was on my staff tour, which was really interesting. And then I went to be a squadron commander. So, you know, throughout the course of my career, I'm a technical expert. I get broadening with education and experience, you know, at the staff level. And then we're asked to command, if we're lucky enough, get the opportunity. So I commanded a unit of 400 airmen, sailors, soldiers, and civilians, because we had a joint unit, meaning multiple services in one squadron. And I commanded that unit for 18 months out in New Jersey. And that was probably the highlight of my career. It was a great opportunity to have direct impact on the lives of, you know, the folks who worked for you and to contribute to the greater mission set of the Air Force. We both trained pilots, flight engineers, and boom operators for a global mobility and air refueling mission, as well as ran all the infrastructure for the operations support for that base, running 2 different airfields, the air traffic control for one of the busiest sectors of the Eastern Seaboard. And so it was a big job, but an amazing one and a terrific opportunity to impact young folks, not only with their careers, but in their personal lives and personal growth and development.
Right. Well, I heard you mention to Michael about how young a lot of these members of the military you were working with were. And it kind of sparked me an area that I'm going to be addressing with someone that I coach with in my gym is this, again, talking of prejudice, this broad sweep that we have over millennials. Like, use the word millennial. It's this horrendous negative connotation. It's someone who's completely useless. And it kind of reminded me, well, wait a second, most of our ground level members of the military are in that generation, and they are, you know, the people that we trust to, as you were saying, secure our airspace and you know, work overseas. So what is your view on that age group and that whole kind of negative connotation of that generation that we have at the moment?
You know, my personal take on a lot of that is, you know, there's a different way of learning, a different way of communicating that they have kind of grown up with, that most of us are, it's either new to us or just unfamiliar. And so I think once you kind of understand how they learn, how they communicate, where they, you know, goes back to kind of my doctoral studies and where I focused on this idea of, you know, where do we get the motivation and the inspiration to continue to do certain things in high stress environments and under pressure? Because it takes kind of like a certain type of person, right, to continue that for the long term. I mean, that there's something that makes a law enforcement or a first responder the type of person that does that type of job. The same thing for military. And, you know, with that, I think this younger generation can really respond to this idea of purpose, of, you know, seeing an end goal of what they're doing and where they're contributing in the world, and kind of how you have to learn what motivates them, how to get them excited about their job. And it goes back to whether you're looking at Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? He's got that pyramid, and at the bottom there's the physiological, right? Do you have a paycheck? Do you have a place to live? You know, the next one is security. Do you feel, you know, safe in your environment? And that's not just physical security, but also psychological security. You know, above that is love and belonging. And then you get to self-esteem and self-actualization. And I think many times, and especially in the past, we've been able to just tell people, all right, you have a job, you have a paycheck, you're safe where you're at physically. Now be awesome at your job, right? And so we kind of jump over a few of those levels of the pyramid, the love and belonging and the self-esteem. And we're like, hey, be self-actualized and awesome with what we're giving you. And I think we're realizing, especially with these younger generations, with the way we have, we are more interconnected. I won't say completely connected, because, and we can talk about that, because there's a difference between being connected in a technological and informational way versus a humanistic, you know, hormone, oxytocin, you know, serotonin, all of those belonging and love type hormones. And that's, I think, what we skip many times, especially in high stress occupations where we get stuck in this sympathetic nervous system, right? This high alert state, this go, go, go. Like, we don't have time for that, right? We don't have time for love and belonging and self-esteem. Like, just do your job and be awesome. And I think what we're learning is that not only with these new the next generations, but the human being itself really needs those two steps, the love, belonging, and the self-esteem. And you really get that by raw human connection. And so when you learn to connect in that way, I think with young people, you can get them to be really amazing at their jobs, because they are very innovative. They are very capable. And I think sometimes we sell them short. And so it was kind of finding that leadership tactic and skill set to really get the most out of and the highest performance out of the people that work with you.
Right. Yeah. The disconnection that you were talking about, I see that obviously in the social media and with all generations, that all of us sort of got sucked into the tablet and the cell phone. And you know, it can go two ways. I look at it, you know, one way, kind of like the Joe Rogan way, where now we have access to all this amazing information that makes us question everything. So as an older generation that were brought up in kind of a, this is just the way it is, you know, just believe it and shut up. Now we get to question all these things, whether it's nutrition or exercise or, you know, whatever it is. But then I think where we fall short as our generation is that we were raised on this false generation or false interpretation of, and I'll take my gender for a moment, of what a man is. So we were raised on the Rambos and the Terminators and, you know, the WWF wrestlers. And I heard you guys talking on Michael's podcast about the ability to show emotion within your profession. And we're just realizing now in our profession that the facade of the stoic firefighter, a police officer that, you know, just goes running in and doesn't have any toll on them is a complete fallacy. And now behind the scenes, we're seeing all these suicides and depression and anxiety and addiction. And I think that's from that generation, from the generation X that were raised on that false image of manhood or womanhood.
Exactly. And I think that's because that image is unsustainable, right? That if for the human being to stay that stoic or disconnected from, you know, the human interaction and the job itself, it's an impossible expectation. And it's really unrealistic for anyone to think that that's going to be sustainable for the long term. And so, you know, my area of study, I would say, is I wanted to learn how to create the most badass human weapon system possible, right? Across the life cycle of a warrior, you know, someone who puts themselves on the line and under pressure. So that's military or, you know, law enforcement, first responders, and, you know, kind of both fit in. And what I've found is that, you know, the key to that, the long-term sustainability for high-performing folks in those rugged environments is that you need the hard work, right? You need to have some type of internal drive, because nothing in this life is free, right? You have to work hard for it. You also have to be properly trained, right, to do the job that you're being asked to do. But those two things together is where you get that stereotype of like, if I just work hard and I've got the training and then I put on a tough face, I can, you know, do whatever I need to do and do it for the long term. And that's just not accurate. You can achieve some levels of high performance with those two pieces, but you're missing out. And what I really studied and what I found is the missing piece, the link between hard work and training and the sustainable high performance piece is command of your mindset, right? It's actually understanding how your mind works and getting control over our thoughts, emotions, the storytelling, our overwhelm, and our stress. You know, I tell people all the time who work in stressful occupations and high stress environments will say things like, well, I'm so stressed. And stress is actually a perceived emotion, right? We have a lot more control over how we see our stress, how we interpret it, how we really perceive our environment around us. It's just learning, right, the right mindset and how to train your mind to get control back over how we see our stress. And so I think that that's very difficult. I mean, it's a difficult concept, which is why you need training for it, right? It's not just something that you can be like, oh, I'm going to get command of my mindset by just thinking I'm going to, right? There's a path and some training that needs to occur really to get us to that space. And so I think for many of us, we're in this sympathetic nervous system, high alert state constantly. And that's what we're trained to do because we need to be, right, alert when you're a first responder. You need to be focused and, you know, in that sympathetic nervous system activation so that you can, you know, fight or flight, right? Like that's kind of the area we operate in. However, the problem is that I don't think any, and I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. And if there's someone out there that knows of a systemic, right? I'm not talking about pockets of people who are doing amazing training with this, but there is no systemic training program or plan for anyone who works in these high stress environments to train them about the parasympathetic system. You know, we only exercise and train in the sympathetic. Right. We train people. Here's how you're going to operate, you know, when things are stressful. Here's, you know, we're going to do simulators of like you're in your aircraft and emergencies happen. And so we get trained to constantly be on that alert, be sympathetically engaged. We never exercise or get trained how to be comfortable in the parasympathetic side of things. And that's the rest and digest. That's the restoration piece. And in order to be really good in the sympathetic, you also need to understand the parasympathetic. And I think that's where, like you were talking about the suicide problems and folks who turn to substance abuse and domestic violence and, you know, all of those problems, I would say the root cause is in mindset and how we make decisions with respect to the stories that our mind tells us, the way we feel under stress and overwhelm. And so when we never practice this parasympathetic slowing down, understanding that it's okay to be comfortable in that space. It's very uncomfortable for people. And so they don't want to be there. And so as soon as life slows down a little bit, they turn to something like substance abuse or, you know, car racing or something that's a little bit more on the eccentric and high speed to get that sympathetic or nervous system activation again. And that's where a lot of dangerous habits and things can occur. So that's part of my work, right? I want to help people understand the slowing down and the value of it so that they can be better when they're alert and in those stressful situations, and then also more manageable just in their day-to-day lives.
Yeah, and I think that's another lie that we've been told, and I think a lot of us subscribe to it, you know, is that, you know, no rest for the wicked, you know, I'll sleep when I'm dead, and even some of our leaders, oh, I'm, you know, I only sleep 3 minutes a year, and I function just fine, and they're like, you know, that's complete crap, but yeah, so we're taught, like, if we're sitting down, and especially a lot of us type A personalities that are really trying to take our careers seriously, you know, you almost feel guilty from not training, not reading, not doing something, but you see that hypervigilance, you see that sympathetic state just never ever deregulating. And it's not just our profession. I've had, you know, men and women on this show who, you know, the elite members of the military, special operators, special forces, who I know for a fact end up in the ER having anxiety attacks and are still dealing with that now. And some of them turn to skydiving or whatever it is to try and fill that void, and it still isn't working. And I think that's because, like you said, you can't out-train the sympathetic nervous system. You've got to rest and recover through that.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why part of my work has been focused on, you know, I think it's great. You know, we all are getting, I think, more resources, both in the military and in the first responder field, for healing and treatment, right? Somebody, hopefully we're starting to destigmatize this idea of someone saying, hey, I need help, and then having the resources available. But I'm the focus of my work is more on the prevention and performance side. How do we teach people these skill sets from the beginning so they don't need as much help on the other side? How do we, you know, start from the beginning teaching, you know, at the police academy or at basic training, teaching the skill sets for people to understand their mindset, to get command of it from the beginning, so that not only will the rest of their training, they'll be more, the information will be more retained, they'll be more focused and high performing in that training space. And, oh, by the way, there is a lot of research and evidence that is proving that these skill sets, especially in the area of mindfulness and meditation, understanding how to emotionally regulate and control our breathing, can also affect our well-being, our relationships with our families, our relationships with our coworkers, and not only our high performance in those rugged environments. So, vitally important. I would love to see it incorporated more in a systemic way across these occupations that we know suffer from the high rates of needing treatment at the end of a career or even in the middle of it, right? We talk about, I'm sure that your career fields and especially in firefighters, we in the military talk about the life cycle of the warrior, the life cycle of an airman. And, you know, everyone comes in and we're never taught, like, you know, the proper ways to treat our bodies. We're never taught yoga and how to, like, stretch, you know, our hamstrings from day one. So by year 10 in your career field, now that you've carried, like, I remember my dad would carry that belt, right? That heavy belt around his waist for years. And, you know, just all of the, are we doing all the right things to keep our bodies and the right muscles being exercised in the right ways so that we can continue to do our jobs for the longevity, both with mental exercise and physical exercise, because I think it's a combination.
Absolutely. Well, just while you talked about airmen for a second, the pilot obviously is in a seated position for hours and hours and hours.
Yep.
Do you, as the military, have you already identified the physiological issues of sitting and therefore employ, like you were talking about, yoga or other movement practices to offset that?
You know, it's interesting because yes and no. And this is the same issue we have where we don't have standard programs. If you happen to be at a unit with a great exercise physiologist or a flight doc, or maybe you're one of the lucky ones that has like an athletic trainer, you may get exposure to that type of prevention exercise from the beginning. But over the general population of the military, no, we do not have enough of that. And that's another thing I've been trying to get. Why don't we teach our young folks from day one about yoga? Because it kind of has a stigma to it, right? Because we're not introducing it. So then when someone, like when I was a squadron commander, I would teach yoga and I taught everyone in my unit how to meditate. And it was seen as this unconventional leadership style and something that was very different. I would love to see that more widely accepted and just a thing that we do, right? You want to be a badass? Then you got to do your mental pushups just like you do physical pushups. We're just not there yet. But I think that the science and evidence is definitely pushing us in the direction that we need to listen to it. And we need to understand that we have to exercise our minds and then also not just exercise our bodies with a, hey, I worked out for, you know, 30 minutes a day, but it's how we're exercising our bodies to be prepared to do our jobs for that long term so that you can be 20 years into a career, and if you were an enlisted aviator that was crawling around in the back of a helicopter on your knees for years, you know, shooting a huge gun, loading pallets, all those things, you learned how to do that properly so that you could still do it and not have back pain and knee problems and this and that at year 15. So I'm going to say I'm cautiously optimistic that these changes are on the horizon and will start to take shape. Hopefully if I can help be a part of that, that would be where I'd like to be most impactful.
Brilliant. Yeah, because that's something that we forget about, especially, I mean, obviously law enforcement is horrendous for this because they're in their cars all day. Fire and EMS, we're sitting a lot more than I think we realize. We feel like we're walking around a lot, but most of the time we're sitting in the vehicle, we're sitting writing reports, even talking to the patient in the back, we're still seated. You see a lot of the injuries that are, you know, backs, especially in the fire service. And I don't think it's from exceptionally large patients. Usually it's just that movement pattern. You're getting tighter and tighter and your hips are turning and turning. And before you know it, seems to be the magic numbers around late 30s, early 40s, the first back injury happens. And this is in a body that was designed to run around jungles and, you know, for decades and decades.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
Right. Well, another area that I harp on a huge amount, and I'm not going to stop doing it until we see change in my profession, is sleep. Now, there is no way around fire, police, EMS, you know, members of the military having to work when it's dark. You know, the bad guys are still out there when it's dark. People still set fire to the house when it's dark. But we have found ourselves specifically in the fire service of these huge 56-hour weeks. These men and women are awake every third day for 24 hours. And so 10, 20 years into their careers, they are, there's no other way to describe it, they're a mess. Their hormones are a mess. They're, you know, musculoskeletally, they're damaged because, again, they don't have that chance to recover. The airline industry is known for being very aggressive in forcing rest and sleep. What is the Air Force's stance on sleep as far as how many hours you need before you can get into a plane again? And also just the overview of sleep as far as a recovery tool.
Well, I would say that the official line would be that sleep is vitally important, that especially in the aviation career field, we have, you know, crew rest. Which means that, you know, prior to performing flight duties, we're required to have 12 hours of uninterrupted rest. Well, I mean, but basically 12 hours of our own personal time where the expectation is that you're getting at least 8 hours of like an uninterrupted sleep. I will say that that's what the regulation says. That's basically kind of the party line. We do keep it fairly protected, right? Like if I knew I was had a flight the next morning and I had to be there at, you know, 4 a.m., then I needed to leave work and no longer perform my work duties, you know, starting at 4 p.m. The afternoon prior. So we're pretty good about that because there's a regulation that protects us. However, what individuals do in that 12-hour period, you know, like they've got, you know, kids' soccer games, and then you've got this event, and then you've got dinner to make, and then, you know, kids to put to bed, and then prepping for the next day. And, you know, there's a lot of other things that kind of play into how our lives are led these days, especially with it's go, 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 right? That's culturally where we're at. And so I don't think the average individual in the military still gets the rest they need. And I think part of that is because going back to that stereotype, you think of what rough and tough means. It means that I don't slow down, and it means that I don't need much sleep, or I tell myself I don't need much sleep. And you kind of wear it like a badge of courage. I mean, I've even seen generals, and in fact, I had a LinkedIn post the other day that was pretty popular. It spurred a lot of discussion. You know, I had a general a few years ago literally stand up in front of an audience of about 2,000 airmen and tell them, well, if I can work out at, you know, 4 o'clock in the morning, and, you know, you guys shouldn't complain about when you get your workouts in. I sleep 4 hours a night and I'm awesome every day. And I was just very shocked that a senior leader would get up in front of a whole crowd and basically promote a lack of sleep hygiene, you know, and I think the military is realizing, I think the stat right now is that our veteran population has like 88% have sleep disorders. From, you know, a career where you're expected to kind of operate on a low amount of sleep, even though the research will tell us that the human body, that is not how we're made. You know, even when you're on a 24-hour shift, right, like you need some type of artificial stimulant to keep you up. Like our, you know, you could say, oh, I can go, you know, a couple weeks without food. I can go a couple days without water. You can't really go, you know, more than 24 hours without sleep, right? Like your body starts to nod off. It starts to shut down. It wants to. And so then you have to stimulate it to stay awake. So I think we're starting to embrace that in the military a little bit with some of our policies, hopefully with some of the language and the strategic messaging our leaders are using to say, hey, you need to rest and recover so that you can be on when I need you to be on, if that makes sense.
No, it does. And then you hear, you see some of these presidents that say they have 4 hours of sleep, and then you watch the before and after pictures of just their term in the White House, and like, God, you look like shit. Maybe you should start sleeping because you look awful 8 years later. So I don't think that's a good poster child for not sleeping either.
Exactly. It drives me crazy too. This is actually a true story. I've walked in to a Monday morning meeting before with some of my peers, and I've heard comments like, oh man, you know, I worked all day Saturday. Like, you know, work is so stressful and busy. I had to work all day Saturday. I've got like a sick kid at home, so I only slept a couple hours last night. I just got my coffee, you know, but I'm here to be awesome. And then the next day, or the next guy says, well, actually, I worked all day Saturday and Sunday because I had to catch up on all that work. I've got two sick kids at home. I only slept like an hour last night, and you know, I don't even have coffee, you know, but I'm still here. And it's almost like we have this competitive stress, right? Like I have more stress than you. Let me show you. And because that means I'm more successful or more busy, means I'm more valued by the organization. And, you know, and then I would kind of sit down and say, well, I didn't work this weekend because I got all my work done last week. My kids are healthy. I sleep great. I've got a yummy green smoothie. I'm, you know, restoring and taking care of myself. And honestly, the sentiment was, well, then you're not working hard enough. Right? That is where we are as a culture. We almost see the self-care piece as like a lazy, you know, like, oh, well, you're not working, or you're not putting in the hours, or you're not, you know, your calendar isn't as packed as mine, so therefore I must be better at my job. And that is just not true in the space of performance psychology and how we achieve the highest levels of our ability to both physically and mentally, you know, push ourselves, you know, in those high spaces. And it's just not the pathway. But we are culturally, I think, stuck a little backwards in how we measure it.
Yeah. I had the Dr. Kirk Parsley on. I don't know if you heard of him. He's a Navy SEAL who went to med school, came back as the West Coast SEAL team's doctor for a while, but he is definitely one of the most brilliant minds that I've come across on sleep medicine after realizing that his Navy SEALs were sleep deprived. They had horrible blood work and they were all addicted to Ambien. And when he fixed that, they completely reversed the issues. But one of the things that he quoted from the sleep medicine world as far as productivity was for every hour, I think, that you lose of sleep, you actually lose an hour and a half of productivity. So it's a myth that, you know, that each hour that you're not sleeping and working instead, that you're doing more, you're actually doing less.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. The science and research, you know, the military used to, we use a lack of sleep as a stress, like as a way to put artificial stress on individuals, right? Like in basic training and stuff, and in different training environments, we rob people of sleep to simulate stress. And so just right there, right? Like a lack of sleep causes increased stress on yourself and on your body. And I think Sun Tzu even had a quote where he's like, when you're not sleeping, you automatically give the enemy an advantage, right? Because if they're sleeping, they're going to be better when you meet them in competition. So that's why I always say, you know, if we don't think you know, our enemies, and it's a little bit different, I think, for the law enforcement, like who kind of like your adversaries are. But at least on a peer-to-peer military type battle that could be for any of us in the future, right? If we're not getting ourselves, you know, giving ourselves the command of the mindset we need, if we're not doing the mental exercise we need to be at the top of our game, if we are not restoring and recovering and understanding how vital self-care and sleep are to our performance in those high stress situations, and our enemy is doing all those things, then we are not going to be as capable and high performing in that space. And that puts us at a severe disadvantage. So it's vitally important.
Yeah, and I think the way it applies in our professions is obviously the enemy. Yeah, I mean, some enemies of the police are training in a crazy way like that, but I think it more manifests itself in us crashing our vehicles, in maybe drawing our weapon when we shouldn't have, or maybe not drawing our weapon and getting killed, you know, by the bad guy. And that's where that cognitive demise, if you were, affects either us or the people that we're protecting.
Definitely. Yes, definitely. Having the ability to self-regulate in those high stress situations, you need that aspect of, you know, I tell people, I know it seems counterintuitive to say slow down to speed up, but in the special operations world, there's a motto that they say slow is smooth, smooth is fast. And so we shouldn't see slowing down as a weakness, but a way to smooth out, right? So you only have to do something once. You don't have to do it multiple times, right? You do it once, you do it right. And that is what leads to the quickness and the agility that we need in certain environments.
Absolutely. Well, you mentioned about the special operations. You were director of human performance and leadership for the 58th Special Operations Wing. Now, what is that wing?
So that was a wing at Kirtland Air Force Base in New Mexico, Albuquerque, New Mexico. And so the Special Operations Wing there was in charge of all of the training for all of the special ops aviation, the various aviation platforms. So AC-130, MC-130, combat rescue helicopters, Huey helicopter training was there, HC-130, which are the helicopter air refuelers, and so and the CV-22s. So all of the students going through, like, they already had gone through kind of an initial qualification training, whether that was original or pilot training or initial flight engineer school, and then they came to the special ops wing to learn the specialty. And so all of our programs were anywhere from like 4 months to an entire year of training. And so we built a human performance center. It was actually the Human Performance and Leadership Center. And we had both facilities, so equipped kind of like a functional fitness center where we would teach yoga, spin, CrossFit, high intensity interval training. We also had a very tight relationship with the physical therapist, with the chiropractor. So all of that was, you know, the psychologists, all of that was readily available to all of our members. But one of the most innovative things we did there, where we collected some great data, was having every student, we added an initial day of training before they started their phase two aircraft specific training, where we did a performance skills workshop. And the performance skills workshop basically included educational pieces as well as practical applications. So we may talk about sleep, and then we would teach them eye rest, integrative restoration, yoga nidra, which is about a 20 to 30 minute meditation. It's a guided meditation that when you kind of come out of it, research is saying not only is it healing for PTSD, but now it puts your mind in this space where it can be very restorative, regenerative. And then also when you come out of the meditation, you almost feel like you had a 2-hour nap. So you have that same level of energy. You don't need your monster drink or your Snickers bar or your afternoon coffee. You just do this meditation and you get, you know, the same effects without any of the side effects and issues. And then also we would do, you know, talk about physical movement, and then we'd do a yoga class, or we would talk about stress and mind wandering and how we can train our attention system. And then we would teach them mindfulness. We also cooked a nutritious lunch, usually something that most people had never really eaten before. One of our favorites was doing a sweet potato chili over quinoa. And you can't imagine how many young folks would be like, what is this quinoa stuff we're eating? And, you know, just educating them on different types of nutrition that are available and how easy it is to cook a healthy meal in your dorm room. Like, you don't have to grab the Snickers bar and Monster drink before you go on your, you know, 6-hour flight, because that's not going to fuel you properly for the mission and the task at hand. So, it was a popular program. It taught them a bunch of skills for them to be more successful in their training program. So yeah, it was great to work with them.
Was the focus of that program, as you said, to extend the life cycle of the warrior, and also glean out the highest level of performance?
Exactly. Yes. I mean, when you think about, so one of the areas that I specialize in is, you know, our attention system. So if you think of your attention system like a flashlight, it can be laser focused externally at whatever's going on in your conscious experience. So what's happening in front of you. It can also be laser focused internally at your thoughts and your feelings and your emotions. And so a lot of psychological disorders happen if our flashlights either become too hyperactive, they switch back and forth too quickly, or maybe they get stuck internally and they can't flip outward. You know, imagine yourself in a very high stress situation. Do you want your flashlight externally focused or internally focused, right? You need it externally focused so that you can rapidly assess the situation and then access your training to do what you need to do. But if you're stuck internally thinking about thoughts, feelings, emotions, like, you know, your sympathetic nervous system is being activated and your amygdala, which is our emotional center of our brain, if you let your emotions take control in those situations, more likely than not, you're going to make an emotional overreaction. And so it takes training, it takes focus. And number one, it takes an awareness, right, that that's even happening. Because many times, you know, we will fly off the handle at someone, or we'll punch a wall, or we'll say something, you know, we don't mean to say, or send that text. And immediately after, you have regret, right? You're like, why did I do that? Because rational thought comes back in and you think, man, I was emotional in that moment and I made a decision that I shouldn't have. So the first step is even being aware that it's happening in the moment. And that's really what I think mindfulness training gives us, is this increased awareness. But then also some of these other self-care performance skills and this ability to tap into the parasympathetic system teaches us that there's value in that space to keep us high performing when we need to be and making more rational decisions, right? That emotional regulation, so that when you have your weapon out, you're not letting your emotions dictate whether you pull the trigger or not. You have resources and skill sets, whether that's, you know, taking deep breaths, having focused imagery, you know, and the thing is these are skills and techniques that you have to do ahead of time. It's not like you can be in the heat of the moment and be like, okay, I'm going to do my 5 push-ups now, right? To be able to physically do my job. No, you've done all the push-ups before so that you could do it. Same thing from a mindset. You need to train your attention system to focus externally, your flashlight to be external, but you have to do the work ahead of time.
Yeah, I was talking to Dr. Judith Glick-Smith about flow state, and it was interesting. She was talking about, obviously, we think of flow state usually as that beautiful state where we're performing at the highest level, but there's also the negative flow state where you get locked in, that kind of chicken with its head cut off. And I've seen that on the fire ground, like literally like a chicken with a head cut off, spinning around in circles, just panicking. But obviously, part of that is training, the physical actual skills training. But like you were saying, I think that important other thing that we miss is clearing the mind of all the white noise, so that when we do hit that high stress event, that we are able to laser focus onto what needs to be done and kind of blur out all the white noise and the irrelevant perimeter that we don't need to be focusing on.
Right. No, and exactly. And that noise and that distraction is really prevalent in our minds today because of, as we were talking about, technology, information overload. You know, I don't know, you probably remember, like, when we used to have to look something up in an encyclopedia.
Yeah. you had to find the right one first. There were hundreds of them.
Right. And so we didn't have information and just knowledge at our fingertips like we do today, and which is a good thing in some ways, right? But it can also add to our overwhelm. It can add to these unrealistic expectations we put on ourselves with the demands of what we are capable of or what we think we're capable of. And so one of the really one of the studies that I always like to kind of quote, you know, when I tell people about distraction and what our minds do, like, they are fantastic at mental time travel, right? If you think of your mind like an iPod, we think a lot in fast forward, right? We're catastrophizing and worrying about the future. We think a lot in rewind, like ruminating, regretting, worrying over the past. And so we, you know, our minds are always on that iPod going back and forth, and we hardly ever just sit on the play button. Right. And that's when you're externally, your flashlight is external and focused in that direction. That's where your attention system is. That's where we want to be the majority of our time. But I think technology, stress, overwhelm, right, creates this mental time travel in our minds. And the statistics will tell us that that happens it's like almost half of our waking moments. It's like 49% of your day, your mind wandering and distracted, and your iPod is on that fast forward or rewind button. And the sad thing about that is the research will tell us is when we mind wander, and we've all done it, right? You've read a page in a book and you get to the bottom and then you think, I don't even know what I just read.
every time I read.
Yeah. Or you have a conversation with someone and then before you know it, you're like, I actually am not paying attention to what they're saying. Or I always use the one where sometimes you drive someplace and then you don't even remember the roads you took to get there. And so that is an unintentional hijacking of our brain called mind wandering. And it's really not productive for us because the majority of the time we mind wander to unpleasant places, our worries, our to-do lists, our stressors. And so just think of that at face value. On any given day, the average human being mind wanders half of your waking moments. So, like, just thinking about that, you know, how much time is wasted? How much lack of productivity are you getting because of your distraction? How much time are you spent in that negative space? So, learning skills and resources to actually decrease the amount of mind wandering and increase the amount of focused attention and presence and awareness is extremely important, not only to our productivity and our well-being, but our, you know, ultimately our performance.
Yeah, I heard a great quote, and it's so simple and just completely true. I mean, it couldn't be any more true. Is worrying about the future is anxiety. Worrying about the past is depression. So happiness is in the present. And if you sit there with gratitude, so not only are you in present, but you are thankful for whatever you have, that's such a powerful tool against anxiety and depression.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I've even, working with some clients, I found, you know, you could experience something or see something on your phone, right? Like many times we have, I think the research now is saying we're having more emotional attachments and responses to our digital devices than we are to the actual relationships we have in our lives. And most of the time, those emotional responses are the negative ones, the frustration, the judgment, the feelings of inadequacy. And, you know, like, I've even woken up, checked something on my phone, gotten a pit in my stomach about something I saw on it, right? Maybe it was an email, maybe it was something on social media. And then you let that carry you throughout the day. And then halfway through the day, you even forget what you were so upset about. But you still hold on to that feeling, right? And you're like, but I'm mad about something, or I feel judged about something, and you don't let it go, right? You have you really have 100% control and power to not respond to those things, right? You can choose not to. But it takes some training and it takes some effort because we as human beings are getting more and more emotionally tied to that sort of thing. And that's why I like to teach in my workshops, and I'm, you know, working with a lot of these high stress populations. I think if you don't have a grounding and anchor point for where you wake up in the morning, you are going to wake up to your digital device and the stress that comes along with it.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I have the 5-minute journal. Have you ever heard of that?
Yes.
Yeah,
yeah, I think that's great.
I love it. So the first thing you do is go sit down in front of that, and it asks you what you're grateful for. So that sets that bar that whatever happens, whatever email you open up, you woke up in a country with no war and you have clothes on your back and your kids are all healthy. So when that's set there, then, you know, whatever shitty email you got is still paling in comparison to what you're grateful for.
Yes, exactly. And I think that that's, you know what, that's a way to train gratitude, right? A lot of these, whether it's optimism or grit or focus or calm, all these aspects of our mindset, they can be trained. You know, they can be trained. And I think many of us get stuck, and I hope that some of your listeners don't feel stuck. And I hope, if anything, like what we're talking about today is giving them a little bit of hope that they can find their way out of it with some skills and resources. And I think those of us that are on the other side, we just need to keep emphasizing to, you know, the people in leadership positions and who have control over the training programs, that we need to bring more of this into those initial qualification level training programs so that we can better equip the next generation, right, for being able to handle not only the stress of their jobs, but then what our digital devices and our culture is kind of bringing in to kind of impact our ability to stay focused. So
yeah, and I think that's having the philosophy that you had in the 58th Special Operations Wing, which is each person that walks through the door is a valuable member of your team, and you completely have the power to extend their life, to extend their physical health, their mental health, and it all can be set. That bar can be set when you walk through a door, and you can either invest your money at the beginning and give them the tools and the working conditions that will allow them to thrive, or you can throw that money at them at the end when they're all broken and retiring or, you know, passing away.
Yes. Yeah. And I think the hard part about what I do in prevention and performance is that some of it is difficult to measure, right? Because I can't prove to you or tell you necessarily what I'm preventing from happening through the work that I do. Now, on the performance side, we are, you know, we can get some results and performance-based metrics for some of the work. And we are kind of, you know, looking into that. And a lot of researchers are continuously pumping out some data. You know, elite athletes are a great resource, I think, for folks in the military and first responder profession to kind of look at and say, hey, here's some techniques and evidence-based practices that they're using, you know, that we can also incorporate to be better at what we do. I mean, I'm not a Patriots fan. I will throw that out there and preface it, but you can't argue with what Tom Brady has been able to do at the age he's been able to do. But if you look at how he's done it, he spends just as much in his parasympathetic restoration recovery space as he does being in his sympathetic, you know, high performing space, because he knows you have to exercise both. And so I like to see that more and more sports teams are integrating the idea of mental exercise, you know, having that practice ahead of time, mental conditioning, and then talking about it, right? Because it's been so secretive for so long. So we will get there.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think there's a paradigm shift. And like you said, the people that are doing well and that understand this are the ones that have to really, you know, push against the grain, as it were, because there is a lot of resistance to change in a lot of these infrastructures that we work under.
Yes. And my advice for anyone out there that's doing it already, you know, what I've learned is talk about it, right? Share it with others. I think, you know, a lot of times when I give presentations, because a lot of it is heavy on this idea of mental exercise and mindfulness, and, you know, people come up to me at the end and it's almost like they're tapping me on the shoulder and just kind of whispering, hey, you know, I meditate. And I'm like, that's awesome. Like, do you share that with anyone? And they're always like, no, no way. No one knows I do it.
Closet meditator.
Yeah, exactly. And so if anything, I hope, especially in military circles, the way that I've been vocal about it, the way that I used it you know, as a leadership tool, right? You know, it was kind of one of those things where if you were in my squadron, we meditated and we connected and we didn't use email all the time. And we, it was just a different philosophy for how we worked together as a team, which led to great results, both at the individual level for a lot of the airmen in the unit, but the organization, right? We won a bunch of different awards, and it was just a great opportunity to prove that this stuff works. But I will tell you, even after that, people are still a little fearful of doing leadership and doing military work in a different way, right? It's almost seen as soft skills, but I will tell you, and anyone out there who has meditated, anyone out there who has focused on getting command of your mindset, it is not a soft skill. It is a hard skill.
It is. But,
yeah.
Yeah. Taming that monkey mind is a nightmare.
Yes.
Well, speaking of that, I've got a gentleman coming on March. He's coming on. But have you heard of the app Headspace?
Yes, I am a big proponent of Headspace. Yes, I always, that's one of my favorite apps because, you know, the research will tell us you should get, you know, about 10 to 12 minutes a day of focused kind of mindfulness meditation, and Headspace gives you pretty much exactly a 10 to 12 minute meditation. So I think it's a easy resource for a lot of folks to at least get started.
Yeah, well, exactly. So I've reached out to Andy and finally got him coming on the show, Andy Puddicombe, the voice of Headspace and the founder. But what I found so great about that app was, like you said, it's that gateway drug trying to get us to even sit still. And where I found it really slotted in on my daily practice was before I went to bed. Sleep is not going to be the right description, but before I got to lay down in the dorm in the fire service, that was my deregulation. And then you, God forbid, you have some of those horrible calls that we have. Again, you put it on for another 10 minutes and you take your mind off all the things that you just went through and deregulate. And it was so incredibly effective for just 10 short minutes.
Yes, I love that. I love that you've used it both ways, right? Before you might get the call and after you get the call, because it's kind of universal. And you just, I think every individual needs to find out what works for them. You know, that's most important. And then the other thing I like to tell military folks, so I'm sure your audience could also appreciate this, is think about, you know, you might already have spaces in your life where you're being mindful. You just didn't know that that's what it was, right? You didn't have the right language to articulate certain activities. So say you're somebody that likes to hunt, or you like to fish, or you like to run. Most of us have an activity that we do that we absolutely love. And the reason why we love it is because we are 100% present and in the moment when we're doing it. You know, if you went hunting or fishing or running and the entire time you were thinking about your worries and your stressors, you wouldn't want to go do that activity again, right? Because you would start associating it with like, man, every time I'm hunting, I'm so stressed out.
Yeah.
But the reason why we love to do fishing or whatever, knitting, whatever that activity is because we have found a way to be fully engaged and present when we're doing it. Now, the problem is some people will say, well, I only do that once a year, or I only do that once a week. And so I would just encourage individuals to kind of find where is that place of contentment and pure focus, and try to make a conscious effort to bring it a little bit more into their daily lives. Maybe it's even parking your car a little further and then actually being present in your walk. Maybe it's when you're waiting in line somewhere now, instead of, like, instinctively we all grab our phones, right? We have no patience to sit and wait for anything anymore. And so we always have to have our digital devices out and in our hands and doing something to kind of stimulate our brain again in what I would say is not a non-productive way. So why not keep that phone in your pocket and actually just take some deep breaths and practice your mental exercise and being in the moment while you're waiting? So there's definitely, you don't have to sit on a pillow with your legs crossed to meditate. Right? Like, you can find that positive breath space, focused attention training kind of almost anywhere.
One thing that I've started doing in my daily routine, my little boy graduated to middle school this year, so he actually takes the school bus now. So I walk him, it's still pitch black in the morning, so I walk him to his bus stop, and then I do like a 30-minute walk with my dog, and I always leave my phone in the house for that very reason. It may not be the same as a guided meditation, but again, there's no distractions. You're just walking. The sun's rising, so you kind of get that gratitude, that initial sunlight on your eyeballs, and in a way that is a form of mental practice.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I love that. That's great. That's good. Especially that you leave your phone, because a lot of people will, say, well, I keep it in my pocket, but I think there's even some of the latest research says that your mind is 20% distracted just by having your phone on your person, because your mind will constantly be going to, did I just hear something? Was that my phone? Did Bob just respond to my text? Did, Cindy just send me an email? you're constantly being distracted by the possibility and the potential that exists by that phone.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, I want to just go over to your TED talk and that journey that you talk about there. You did a fantastic TED talk about, being, as we talked about at the beginning of this, this interview, extremely successful person and owning each level of the promotional process up to lieutenant colonel. But you talked about that crossroads, when you became a mother. So would you mind kind of leading us down that, what your concept of hard work was and then what you kind of discovered at that point?
Yeah. So I think my story is relatable to a lot of individuals, right? We kind of start off in our career as those technical experts and we want to be badass at what we do. And so, especially if you also have, I'm a parent and I'm a spouse and maybe you're a volunteer. And so you serve in a different way. You kind of want to be badass at everything you do, right? Like you want to wear that hat no matter which one it is and be amazing. And we put a lot of pressure on ourselves with that. I know that I did. And found myself in a space where I forgot how to laugh. I lost sight of all the love that was right in front of my face. I was so busy trying to be perfect in everything that I did and fearful, right, of not being perfect, that I forgot the fact that there's growth and learning within our imperfections as human beings. And so I found myself in this really dark space. And the crazy thing is for all intents and purposes, somebody would look at me from the outside and think, man, she's so successful and she's got it all together and look at all these things that she's doing. And I was. And in fact, I think for many of us, success can be our enemy in those situations because we're rewarded for the decisions, right, we make to go, 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 stress, 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 stay busy. And so it gives us this false sense of this is how I achieve success. And I have to keep going in this same pathway to continue to be successful. So I, have a theory that most of us only change through some sort of pain and suffering. And so until we see that, it's difficult for us to want to make a change. And I think for a lot of type A people, a lot of high stress people, that is an accurate assessment. And so I kind of hit this burnout point. My husband was deployed for a year to the Middle East. We had a 2-year-old daughter. I was leading a unit. I needed to be the best pilot, the best mom, the best spouse, the best whatever. And it did. I was in this very dark place and I burnt out to the point where I was kind of like, what am I doing? Like, is this where I want to be in my life? It was almost crazy because I was so successful, from the outside. But what I learned in that process that I was lucky enough to get sent to school, and instead of really wallowing in it, I decided I want to do something about it. Like I want to study how I can operate in all facets of my life to the best of my ability, despite the stress and overwhelm that I might be feeling. And that's really what led to my PhD work, because I wanted to find not just it was a little out of self-necessity, right? Like I needed to find a solution to continue. But I also wanted to find something that was universal to help a lot of others that I knew were in the same exact position as I was. And ultimately, that's kind of where I started my work on, you know, how do you create the most badass human weapon system from a strategic health and a wellness, holistic wellness perspective. And that's for this aspect of self-care, slowing down, you know, against that cultural norm of competitive stress came in, especially the idea of, I use the analogy, mindfulness and meditation is kind of like an oxygen mask for your productivity, your efficiency, and ultimately your performance and everything that you do. So that's where it starts, because I think once you bring mindfulness, gives us the awareness of how we're making decisions, of how we're living our life, of how much we are taking care of ourselves. Once the awareness kicks in, we can make better decisions across the spectrum of how we live our lives and the types of healthy behaviors or unhealthy behaviors we have. So yes, that was kind of, you know, I have like that burnout story in space, and I just want to help others realize that we don't have to get drowned and caught up in that overwhelm and stress. If we slow down a little bit, we'll see the good things in life. Like, I was going so fast, all I saw was my stress and my laboring. And, you know, my TED Talk, kind of my last lesson is, you know, my philosophy that I wake up and live every day is I don't balance my life. I harmonize it with my four L's, and that's labor, laugh, love, and learn. And not that I do those four things in equal parts every day, just that I slow down enough to experience all of them every day. So I do work hard and I labor, but I don't do it at the expense of laughing and loving and learning every day. And that's what I try to teach my kids. Yeah. From the beginning.
Well, and then that's something I think that is a kind of epidemic at the moment. And one thing that I heard someone talking about, and it's so, so true. If you work in a 9-to-5 job, when do you ever get to 5 o'clock and go, wow, all the work I had to do today is done. I can go home and know that there's nothing waiting for me in the morning. It's a never-ending cycle. No matter what profession you're in, there's always going to be work. So, you know, as I heard you say, I think it was with Michael again, being okay to say, I didn't get this done today, but I've stopped now because, like you said, I'm going to be present with my kids. That will be there tomorrow. I'll deal with it then.
Yeah, I would, you know, the awareness piece really for me also brought in how much when I was at work, I was stressed and worried about what a horrible mom I was being, right? And then when I was at home, I was stressed and worried about how horrible of a professional I was being, right? And once I brought that awareness in, I was realizing, man, I'm not being super productive at work, nor am I being super present with my kids. Like, neither place am I at my best because I'm worried about the other side. And so it's like when you're at work, be at work, be present at work. When you're at home, be present at home. And just that ability to kind of switch and focus your mind can be extremely powerful for how you feel overall and how you have better relationships both at work as a leader and a coworker and then at home with your spouse and kids.
Yeah. Do you think that there's a loss of understanding our why these days as well? Like when you question, you know, why you got into the career in the first place, why you took the promotional test, that when you boil it all down again, it was for your family, which is the one thing that you're neglecting because you're always at work.
Yes, definitely. And I think, you know, I think that there is a way that we can be amazing professionals, but also really connected with our families. I don't think it has to be an either or choice. And really it lies in the being mentally engaged. You know, there are so many times I talk a little bit about it in my TED Talk, so I won't rehash the whole thing, but you know, how many times are we physically present with those that are most important to us than our families, and we're mentally checked out? You know, we're sitting at dinner with them, we're in the car with them, and we're mind wandering. We're not even having like an engaged conversation. And those are just missed opportunities for developing connection and deeper relationships. And do you know what we get when we connect with another human being? Is we get oxytocin, and we get, you know, the positive hormones that also contribute to decreasing the cortisol and the stress levels. You know, I think there's something to be said for having kids. I know for me, I was kind of workaholic. And then as soon as you have kids, you come home and it doesn't matter what you did that day, right? You could have done, like, I could have had a check ride that I did not do very well on, or I did not perform my best on my landings that day, whatever it was. But I walk in the door and those kids are like smiling and excited to see you. And, you know, it brings that kind of into perspective so that the rest of the evening, I'm not dwelling on the fact that I messed up that one landing, right? I'm more present and focused with the love that I feel by the connection with those family members. And I think many of us miss that because we're still at home. We're physically with those family members, but all we're thinking about is how we messed up at work that day, or how we, you know, somebody made us angry and we let that carry us. I think, you know, there's 86,400 seconds or 1,440 minutes in a day. How often do we let one thing that happened for 10 seconds or 1 minute affect the rest of, you know, those moments? So just something.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've come back from some horrible shifts and, you know, the, like you said, the hug from my son or even just petting my dog, you know, that is so engaging. But I've never gone and checked my Facebook and be like, oh, I feel so much better now. I updated my status. It just doesn't work that way.
It doesn't. That's rarely. The social media aspect of our lives today, you know, we rarely find the goodness on social media because social media is kind of an area where the negative thrives. So it can be very dangerous, for our minds, which is why we need skill sets and tool sets, which, oh, by the way, are ancient. Like this is nothing new for human beings, right? Like I don't feel like, you know, and many of us in kind of the mindfulness and meditation and mindset movement are kind of saying, hey, we're creating this from scratch and this is a new thing. It just sounds new because it's kind of lost its way for a while, but hopefully we're going to work to bring it back.
Yeah, that's been the theme of this whole project as well, is deconstructing or reverse engineering a lot of the crap, but for lack of a better word, that we were taught. And we have, you know, and I'll say we, my generation and the one above me and the one below me, have this arrogance like, oh, now we know how to grow food. Now we know how to exercise. Now we know, you know, how to dispense medication. And then we look back prior generations like, absolutely no, we completely screwed this up. How our great grandparents farmed is how healthy food has grown, and how, you know, the yogis meditated is so much better for our minds. And so I think we're starting to realize now that the last few decades were kind of a cluster, and we've got to undo some of the damage that we did.
Yes, definitely, definitely. And we didn't even really touch on nutrition today, but that's, you know, another vital aspect, I think, of overall wellness and performance, right? Like how you eat and what types of food you eat. And you're right, it's kind of going back to whole foods and roots. In a lot of different ways, but I'd like to think, especially as, you know, also a researcher and an innovator, it's finding a way back to our roots using some of the goodness, right, that our technology and our culture today have. We just have to understand that it shouldn't be at the expense of who we are as human beings, right? It should be a complement to that. I'm hopeful.
Yeah, me too. Well, very quickly, because I don't want to take your time up, and we'll do some wrap-up questions after this, but what is the kind of nutritional philosophy, the overall kind of advice that you give people when they're looking to improve their health?
So my biggest, I've just two biggest probably points with respect to nutrition. The first is eat more whole foods. Right. We all should. And any reputable dietitian or nutritionist today would say we all as a culture need to eat more plants. So I'm not going to say you need to follow any type of specific diet, because I don't like the idea of a diet, because that means something that requires hard work and it's temporary. Like, you should have a whole food eating philosophy. Don't eat too much. Right. And make sure that what you're eating, I think, should have a substantive amount of whole foods and plants. And just because that is where the majority of the research will say we can be healed, you know, more focused, higher performing, helps our brain function, helps our overall body optimize itself. And then the second piece, And what I mean by whole food, just in case anyone has questions about that, like food that is as close to as nature intended, right? Like, so an apple is a whole food. Apple juice is not a whole food, right? It's been processed in some way. And then with that, finding whole foods, reading labels, right? Many of us don't even understand what we're looking at a label. So if you turn over a product and the label just says carrots on it, that's awesome. That's a whole food. If you turn over the label and the first word is something you can't pronounce or the first word is sugar, put it back. It's probably not the best thing for us. In fact, we eat more food-like substances than we do food today. And I think the stat is something like 90% of what exists in a grocery store did not exist 100 years ago. So just think about it that way, whole foods. And then the second aspect is I think everyone should do some type of, I call it like a recharge, a healthy food recharge, once or a couple, up to three times a year, where you kind of focus and kind of cleanse and detox your system. You know, our bodies have a natural ability to detox themselves. However, if you never stop eating, meaning you eat up until like 10 p.m. at night and then you're eating, you know, like 6 a.m. in the morning, and the thing you ate at night was something very heavy, like a big steak meal, and the thing you were eating in the morning is like sausage and eggs, your body will never have the ability to stop digesting and then move into the detox process. So I'm a big advocate of, you know, allowing our bodies its natural process of detoxing and cleansing. And you kind of have to do a little bit of a fasting with that. So I have some programs I support and I recommend, one of which is the Clean Program by Dr. Alejandro Junger, J-U-N-G-E-R. And basically he talks about, he goes, it's a really short read, quick read, but he talks about going into this idea of how we detox our bodies and kind of a healthy eating program that's based on whole foods. So yeah, so if anyone has any questions about that, they can also reach out to me, but I highly recommend that. So two-part, more whole food eating and reading labels, and then secondly, offering our bodies the chance to do what it's meant to do.
Brilliant. All right. Well, we're speaking of books. So my first closing question, and when we get to the end of this, I don't want to talk about what you're doing with Michael Gervais, but the first one, is there a book that you recommend? So you mentioned Clean. Are there any other books that you love to recommend, either what we spoke about today or something completely different?
Yes. So I actually do a Leaders or Readers series. So every week I post a new book on LinkedIn. I'm an avid book reader. And in a lot of my speeches, I throw up a slide that has about 40 books on it. So my website also has a lot of my book recommendations, but my number one top first favorite book that I think everyone should read is called Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl.
It's sitting right next to me as we speak.
Is it really?
It is. Yep.
Yes. That's awesome. Awesome. I love that book. Yeah. I think it's just a great way for individuals to kind of dive into both, you know, from the historical perspective of Viktor Frankl's experience in the Holocaust, but also kind of his analysis. And it makes you, I think, deep dive and soul search a little bit about what is most important to you. Like, why do you get up in the morning? What gives you purpose? And then I know Mike Gervais and I have had conversations about having similar thoughts and, you know, having a philosophy, right? Like, what is your go-to mantra when you wake up in the morning, so that instead of, you know, being tied to digital media or getting up with that pit in your stomach of worry about what might have happened yesterday, you start from a positive space, a foundational anchoring of who you are and where you're going in life. And I think that book is a great tool to help you get there.
Absolutely. And if you're pissed off because you broke your iPhone, read that and realize that your day's going really well.
Exactly.
All right. What about the same question? A movie and or a documentary?
Ooh, wow. That's a good one. You know, I have watched quite a few. I would say one of the most interesting documentaries that I've watched as of recently. I liked Forks Over Knives. You know, I am a big proponent of less drugs, less surgery, more healing through, you know, holistic practices, you know, getting our mind in the right space and our body both physically and nutritionally. And so I think that that's a really good and some might say controversial, but I like to say thought-provoking, right? It made me want to read more research about how foods make us feel and how we could turn more to whole foods on our plate rather than, you know, the surgery and pill aspect of health. And, you know, I say it all the time in military populations, and I'm sure as well in law enforcement and your field, you know, what is most available to us while we're on our shifts are things like pizza and hamburger, you know, fast food, hamburgers. And so those are the foods we tend to fuel our bodies with, but that is so anti high performance. You know, I don't want my air traffic controllers drinking a 2 liter of Orange Crush and eating a pizza before they go and control the most, you know, high and fast paced area of airspace, right? Securing that airspace. But yet that is what's most available to them on their budget. And so it's trying to figure out ways to educate individuals on how to eat better foods. And so I think that that's a great starting documentary for that.
Brilliant. Yeah, I love that documentary. I think there was a lot. I mean, whether you choose to include meat in your diet or not, that you still eat plant-based and then you just add clean meat to it. But I had Joel Salatin on the show, who was the farmer in Forks Over Knives, and then I had Rip Esselstyn as well. You know, he was the son of Dr. Esselstyn. He had the plant-based diet, the Firehouse Edition that he put together.
Oh, that's awesome. That's great. I'll have to listen to that episode.
Yeah, it was very good. But Joel, I can't wait. I'm going to go and visit his farm this year. He just, again, it's common sense. He's raising meat, obviously, but again, the way that these animals are raised, the ways that these animals are fed, you know, it just makes perfect sense.
Yes.
All right. The next question. Is there a person that you would recommend to come on this podcast to talk to the military and first responders of the world?
Oh, wow. You know who, have you had David Goggins?
He is coming on this year. He's done a huge amount of podcasts. He just released his book. So he's all kind of podcasted out. But they said that they're only doing a handful of podcasts in 2019, and this is going to be one of them. So I'm patiently waiting until they're ready. And probably later this year, he's going to be on.
I love it. I think your audience would just really get a kick. I mean, he's really raw. And I think that he's someone that in your communities and populations, people would be able to relate to and kind of admire. So yeah, that's awesome. I'm very excited that you would have him on, because he was on Finding Mastery shortly after I was with Mike Gervais. So yeah, I think that's great. I think, you know, Pete Carroll also might be a really good guest as well, because he kind of talks about how you lead and build an organizational culture around some of these philosophies and into wellness and mindset. And so he might as well.
Fantastic. Well, that's a good segue. So while we're on the Pete and Michael, you are developing something with them at the moment to bring to the military and first responder community. Would you mind telling me about that?
Yeah, sure. No problem. So I, you know, do a lot of, since the last year I was on active duty, I spoke a lot about my work, both as a squadron commander, my dissertation research, and my work at the Special Ops Wing. And many times I'll give a keynote or I'll teach a workshop, and I always get asked, you know, for more, right? Like, what else can we do? Or how can I bring this to my unit or my coworkers or my organization? And so I recently partnered with Mike and Pete to build a warrior mindset training program that's experiential, that is taught by peers, right? So we have three phases. The first phase is a workshop, and it's taught. It's either a 4-8-hour workshop on mindset taught by an elite military operator like myself or someone on my team, and then an Olympic athlete. So people who have used this in the trenches and then, you know, studied it. And the whole program is based on the work of Pete, Mike, and I. So it's, you know, thoroughly researched based on scientific evidence and evidence-based practices. And so it's at the workshop, and then it's an 8-week digital training platform that is individualized, right? So you have an embedded military operator or Olympic coach that's kind of taking you through all of the resources. It's kind of work at your own pace. And it's self-reflective, right? Like not only will you learn how to train, specifically train grit and optimism and focus and calm and learn the mindfulness skill sets, but we also address recovery, you know, and how to build the proper mindset to be a badass at what you do. So, yeah. And then the third phase is an app. So we kind of have workshop, digital training platform, and an app. And so now it kind of gives me an ability to not just have an impact for one day and give a keynote, but actually build a sustainability plan for these organizations to really incorporate the idea of mindset and growth into their daily lives and that of their culture.
Fantastic. Well, as soon as it is live, you have to let me know and I'll share it on all my platforms. It sounds like a great tool for my community to be able to use as well.
Exactly. And I think it's, you know, I've done a lot of research and I've been doing this, you know, sharing it within the military for years. And I have just found that our populations tend to be very responsive to the, you know, military operator slash athlete model of using this, these concepts, because that, you know, we all kind of feel like we're warriors in our daily lives and what we do. And so that's something that I think resonates and is, you know, people can relate to incorporating something as stigmatized as meditation and kind of this self-care piece in that way.
Yeah, I think when people realize that how they think they are perceived by other people is far less important than how they take care of themselves, when they get over that, you know, what do I look like hurdle, they'll realize just how beneficial and powerful this is.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. So then the final one before we talk about where we can find you, I know we've been talking a lot about mental practice today, but is there anything else aside from that that you do personally to decompress?
So I actually just recently moved to Utah, and I have never lived this close to kind of the mountain environment. I off and on, I grew up on the beach in California, and then I went to Colorado for school, and I went to the Air Force Academy, and I learned to snowboard, but it was kind of like a sporadic hobby of mine. I have now become a skier for the first time. I learned to ski this season, and it has become like my place. I'm now, you know, semi-retired, right? I retired from the military, and then, you know, my next career, this is, it has a lot of flexible time. So every Tuesday I go skiing by myself, and it has become my new meditative, self-reflective. Like sometimes I'll listen to a podcast. Sometimes I will just be one with nature. And I have found it to be like my new favorite activity. And my like a critical aspect of my self-care.
Yeah, I love it. I haven't been for 6 years, and we're actually going for the first time in 6 years next month to Colorado. And yeah, I don't think you can explain to someone what it's like standing on the top of a mountain with just a piece of wood strapped to your feet, and just you know, pointing your board downhill, and the cold and the blue skies and you know, the powder and just all like you said, all those real world inputs instead of the digital one. It's absolutely soul cleansing to me.
It is. It's so valuable. So that's my new activity to combine with, you know, my normal mindfulness practice. And I do yoga also. So yeah. Kind of find, you know, I tell everybody, find those activities that just bring you presence and joy, you know, and then stop saying, oh, I wish I could do that more often, and start finding ways to kind of incorporate it. Because maybe it's even giving back and volunteering. You know, I found a lot of goodness in those activities as well for myself. So yeah, find what works for you.
Perfect. All right. So then the very last question, I'm sure people are going to have questions for you, want to reach out to you, be looking for the new platform. So what's the best way for people to find you online and reach out to you?
So I'm on all the social media platforms. So anyone can either follow or link in, you know, like link in with me, or I have a professional Facebook page. Where, you know, on all of my social media, I tend to post across the human performance space. So sleep, nutrition, mindset, movement and physical activity. What I think is, you know, thought-provoking, updated research and information. So you can find that on all those platforms. I also have a website, If anyone has any, you know, specific questions, you can email me through the website, or my email is janelle@janellemcauley.com. Feel free if you have, you know, I do keynotes and, like I said, teach workshops, and hopefully in the next couple months, we'll have a follow-on program for organizations to use to really capture mindset and culture change. So yeah, I would love, I mean, law enforcement, first responders, near and dear to my heart, as is the military. I mean, I love working with corporate clients as well, but I know the population that can most benefit from the information I present and teach are those of us that put our lives on the line. And I'd like to think, from being one of the folks that have done that and then extensively studied it, I would just love to continue to impact, you know, my communities in deeper ways. So happy to answer anyone's questions or help.
Brilliant. Well, I want to thank you because you already have impacted just from this podcast alone. And, you know, it's been a fantastic conversation. A lot of people are going to get yet another different perspective in this kind of, these layers of this onion are growing and growing and growing. But I'm looking forward to your project with Michael. And, you know, I look forward to putting this out and getting this incredible interview to the people that need to hear it.
Yeah, thank you so much for inviting me. I've had a great time with you today. And I thank everyone out there for their service to keeping all of us safe.